Ian, thank you so much for joining me today. Super excited to chat with you. I was going through your LinkedIn to kind of build this intro of yourself. Really, really impressive background. All right, you're a game dev veteran of 23 years, which is insane. You've worked at places like EA, Rochambeau, Zynga, Pop-Up Play, FanDuel. And obviously, you found a third time. Absolutely incredible background. But tell me, like, how did you first get involved in game dev?
Yeah, that's a kind of a fun story. I mean, I was in college, University of Tennessee, kind of floundering around. I was a good student in high school and everything, but the freedom of college, definitely, I wasn't prepared for. And so I had taken some computer science. I was a, the background of my life, I was always a huge gamer. I mean, I was obsessed with video games. I played guitar, I played soccer, and I played video games. That was like my life every day for, the majority of my youth. I was really into games. I went to college thinking, oh, I want to make games. But University of Tennessee in 1998 did not have a game development program. So I started taking computer science and hated it. It was all like they were still showing it on an overhead projector with like pen. It was just like, it's obviously not very fun. And so it just so happened out of nowhere, NCAA Football 99, the EA Sports game, they had a road show, a couple of guys from Orlando. Would drive around in a van to top tier schools and have tournaments. And it was their way to recruit game testers to come play and come to Orlando during the summer for, basically the seasonal testing of each year's title. And so one of my buddies was a really, really good NCAA football player, and he won the tournament in Tennessee. So they offered him a job as a game tester. And he said, well, can some of my buddies come? They're really good at games too, and this is, you look back on it, and they're like, "Yeah, whatever," they didn't care. And so I showed up on the door of EA Sports that summer of my sophomore year, no job, but just showed up and said, "Hey, they said that we could work here," and they're like, "Yeah, whatever, go over there, check out Madden 2000 PC." So that was my testing, and I mean, it was just like. The heavens opened up. It was like, this is what I always wanted to do. Just trying to figure out even what testing was. I had no idea. There wasn't like there was training. I mean, this was just so much, very early. But it was so exciting. I got to meet programmers. Like the guy that did the player ratings came in, and to me, he was like a celebrity. I'm like, oh my God, this is he, what? How does he do that? Everything was just so new to me that it was so unbelievably exciting. And I mean, I really felt like I carried that wonder. I still carry that wonder. There's so much like. You just type into a computer and then the game's out. I would sit in programmers' cubes to try and test something for them. And I would just be like, what are you? They're just typing numbers and letters and code. And all of a sudden the guy does the, I was just absolutely hooked. But they gave me a job offer at the end of that summer. So typically they kick out all testers. They're like, all right, thanks for your help. Beat it. And I was one of the top testers. Of course, I was obsessed with it. I felt like there's no way I'm losing this job. So they gave me a job offer to be like a commentary writer on NCAA 2001 or something. And I said, nah, I got to finish college. I've got my mom's going to kill me if I drop out of school. I got to come. I got, I'll come back. And I get back to college. And within like 3 weeks, I'm like, why the hell did I say no to that job? It was just like, this is so stupid. I was hating college, and so I just basically stopped going, and withdrew that semester, and then reached back out, and they were like, "Yeah, okay, we'll hire you now." But then they strung me along, strung me along, strung me along. So I basically ended up like living back with my mom. I mean, she was so patient to deal with this, like, such a promising kid who's now like dropped out of school and is just living at home, playing poker with my buddies on Thursday nights, the other guys that dropped out of college, in my hometown. But I was really resilient to EA. I was like, I would email them every week. Hey, is it ready yet? When can I come? I'm ready to come. I'll move down whenever you want, And so finally around February, so a good like 3 months of living at home with my mom, they finally gave me an offer to do QA. A senior tester. So I didn't get into production. Production was would have been the commentary writing. I had to stay in testing, but they gave me a job as a senior tester on NASCAR. And I was like, you got it. I'll be there on Monday. Packed up all my crap and showed up. And I didn't care what game it was. I didn't care what it was, just like I had to get my foot in the door. And so then, yeah, it was really like, you know, NASCAR to Madden. I was just, you know, just obsessed with the process. So it was just always fun for me. I worked all the time. I was there every day, every night. You know, I would sleep at work sometimes. I would stay, you know, I would stay up and make builds and play pinball. And it was just like, this is unreal. This is an unbelievable job. And just grinded my way. But I think around Madden 04 is when they finally said, well, why don't you come up and write some designs and join production instead of testing? And that was like really the, you know, the magic. Once you could get in and actually start making things, I started running motion capture shoots and doing animations and really getting into the gameplay side of things. And just, again, it was just a small team. You think back, like, okay, Madden's been this massive franchise, when it really was just like a group of 5 to 10 people kind of making all the decisions on these huge games. And so it was always really electric. And yeah, so that's how I got started. It was really like, you know, out of nowhere happenstance to get the testing job. And then once I got in, I was like, I'm not leaving.
That's amazing. Okay, wow. Okay, so, and this is all at EA. And I think you spent like maybe eight, nine years there, I think?
Yeah, actually, just over a decade.
Okay.
Yeah, because they, wow. I left, like, they gave me a mountain bike for my decade anniversary, which was a weird gift. But I remember getting the mountain bike and then quitting.
Nice. Yeah. Okay, so, but at EA, did it give you kind of a, because you mentioned you were at different, you were working in different kind of sections of the company, and did that give you a nice base foundation to go do your own thing, or like, to tell me about that evolution after, or I guess during EA and then after?
Yeah, I mean, it did, but it was really all kind of on my own. So, I mean, EA is obviously, especially by the time I left, was a very large organization. You know, I was the creative director of Madden 10 and 11 and 12, and I think it was 150 people, you know, kind of on that team, as well as probably another 100 or 200 external help, you know, marketing or QA or this and that, localization things. So it was a huge squad. And I had found around 2005, 2006 timeframe that I was just really getting burned out on, you know, the typical way you work there was that the designers wrote just hundreds of pages of documents as soon as the game shipped. Here's all the things we want to change. You write for 3 months, you know, you take screenshots, you do this, and then you'd throw it over the wall and wait for the devs to get to it. Inevitably, they would cut 95% of it, you know, and it was just so frustrating working that way in this very like no progress. And of course, I like crunch, and then you just have nothing to do. And then the, you know, once the stuff is implemented, then they're like, all right, hey, you got to go tune it all. And then you're crunching again, you know. And so it was just this really like annoying level of not being in control while still sort of being empowered to be in control, but not being able to do anything. So around 2005, 2006, there was a programmer there at EA, this guy, Dave Swanson, who's still there. I think he's actually was there 5 years before I was. He's probably been there for 30 years now, if I think about it. Super great guy. And he held a course on programming and just said, hey, if anybody wants to learn how C# works, you know, we're starting to build tools in C# and stuff. And so I went down and took that class. And I mean, it was just this huge eye-opening moment. And again, I had taken original computer science at UT, which was just horrible. You know, no debugging, no visualization, no IntelliSense, just very brutal original origins of programming. And then I get to C# and I'm like, oh my God, this is actually really fun. And so from that point forward, I was just obsessed with learning how to code. And so I spent all my time, free time, building stuff, trying stuff, creating all kinds of little apps or ideas or things like that. And so eventually by, you know, a year or two, I was able to write code in the Madden code base. And so that was sort of my way to then, like, that was how I actually kind of shot up the ranks within EA. It was like all of a sudden I became a self-contained person that could just build stuff on my own. I have an idea. I obviously had all the design background. I could get animations. I could go do motion capture. I could kind of build everything myself. And so that's where I started feeling around that time of like, okay, I'm in my element. I'm kind of in my prime. And as I got to that level, that's when EA started promoting me and all this stuff. And as I got promoted at EA, then all I did was freaking meetings. You know, it was just like PowerPoint after PowerPoint after PowerPoint. That's all I did. And I'm like, oh no, I'm actually getting really good at this other thing. I feel this was really fun, like building features and, you know, talking to the community, and it was just like that part was exhilarating. And then all the, on the professional side, they're like, no, we got some guys coming in town. We need you to make a deck and this. And you need to get your gate review, you need to do this. And it was just this crazy amount. I would have basically 8 hours straight of meetings nearly every day. And so I just got so burned out, and that's what caused me to end up like, I felt like I was in my prime, even though I wasn't. You know, I felt like I had learned so much about programming, but of course I didn't know anything really, but it was enough to kind of be dangerous. And so that's what gave me the bravado, I think, to eventually leave. Just like, I got to do something else. I'm solving the same problems here. I'm in meetings all day. I'm so burned out. I mean, almost everyone I know that got to that level at EA can't take it. You know, it's just like, you got to get out of here, because it's just depressing. You know, like when you're a creative person, you want to build stuff, you just want to be like close to the metal. And that role is just not that. You know, you're up 150 people trying to manage deadlines and guidelines. And, you know, so it's just kind of how it is in a corporation, really. I think, like, if you're really good at your craft, you get promoted away from your craft. So anyway.
All right. So after EA, what was kind of the thought process going forward where you're like, all right, I want to get more experience at different studios and kind of be closer to the actual action? Or was it, I want to go start my own thing? Like, what was that? What was that thought process?
Yeah, exactly. So the trigger to leave EA was that the GM of the Tiburon Studios, guy Philip Holt, who all of us loved. I mean, he was a great lead of that studio. And basically EA around 2011 or whatever did some weird reorg, and they just reorged him right out of there. It was just like, oh, sports are going to report to this pillar, and this pillar is going to report to that guy in Canada. You know, it's just one of those things that happened, you know, where corporate people need to figure out what to do with their time. And so Philip basically gets kind of laid off. And so he sort of just was like, I'm starting my own company. And there were sort of rumblings that, like, he's going to start his own company, you know. And so it just, like, we all, seven of us ended up all just sort of like finding that out and leaving on the same day to go join Philip at Rochambeau. And that was his studio. You know, he went and raised a venture round and we joined him. And that was just electric. You know, this, like, top tier engineers and people from EA over in this new, brand new area. We were looking at basically at mobile and at Facebook, you know, really early in that. We were just super inexperienced. And didn't understand, like, free-to-play monetization at all. That had just come out. And so we were just, I think we took so much for granted the marketing machine of EA and, like, how no matter what you make, like, 6 million people will just check it out. And so that was a big, like, eye-opener. But so it was about learning new things, though. I felt like I learned within a year at Rochambeau more than I'd learned at EA in 10, because it was just, like, every piece of technology, new things, just all of a sudden, you know, EA is we mentioned it a lot, is like, EA is great. It's kind of like a steady diet of steak. And eventually you're like, all right, enough is enough. Every year we're just having steak over and over again. Madden 10, Madden 11, Madden 12, Madden 13, another steak. So it was so exciting to try and, like, how does mobile work? How do Facebook games work? And what is Farmville doing? How did they make $1 billion? Like, what, you know? And so you just start, like, researching what's going on in the industry and outside of the little bubble of sports. So yeah, that was really the sort of reason to jump, was sort of burned out and then an opportunity to try new things. But after Rochambeau, so the writing was on the wall there. We were, you know, ripping through Runway and no you know, monetization at all. Our games were super well reviewed and enjoyed, high retention, all these things. They were well loved, but just no money coming in. And so the writing was on the wall. And so that was where I was just like, okay, I need to learn how to monetize free-to-play games. I don't know what I'm doing. I am a designer. I'm a creative director. I'm a studio design director level at this point, and I have no idea how this stuff works. You know, I was researching games, but I was like, okay, CSR Racing was one of the first ones that I'd seen that had really kind of nailed a good model on monetization. Of course, Zynga had drilled it. So that's when I reached out and got started a studio here in Orlando for Zynga. So I spent 3 months at the Zynga San Diego studio, kind of like entering, which was really great. I worked with one of my mentors was Mark Turmel, who was the creator of NBA Jam and NFL Blitz, just super great guy. He was the studio head out there at San Diego and Zynga. And so I went and just was kind of an understudy with him for 3 months, trying to figure out what was their PM culture like? How were they monetizing Farmville? How were they approaching games? So that was really like, once I had that, once I unlocked a lot of the ideas and thoughts there, then I was really like, I got to start my own company. I felt like I knew again, then I really felt like I was in my prime, because it's like I'd learned how to free play, I'd learned all the AAA stuff, I'd learned how to do marketing and relationships, and so it was like, all right, I'm now fully rounded, and I can do all this myself, and so that's what I did.
And that first endeavor, was it first endeavor by yourself? Was that third time?
Yeah, it was. Well, Photo Finish, the original Photo Finish horse racing, was just me. Built it over the course of about a year on my own time, and released it under my name. You know, it was like under Ian Cummings, personal, on only in Australia. And I did that around 2014, and I kind of couldn't. So again, I felt like, okay, I know how to do this. I can do this all myself now. It's really, really empowering, of course, and terrifying and fun. And so I released it only in Australia just to kind of check it out, see how it did. And I couldn't believe what was happening. It was like, I would put it out, it would get 30 installs, right? There's no marketing, and it would pay, $40. And I'm like, that can't be right. So then I'd put the $40 back into a Facebook ad campaign in Australia, and that $40 would get, 80 installs or 800 installs. Like sometimes there were these crazy, like big things. And then those installs would pay back $1,000. And so the payback velocity was so quick on that game. The retention was so high that I was able to just start like compounding this game within just a couple of months. And I didn't know what I was doing from a Facebook ad standpoint or anything, but it was really just like, again, me learning it on the fly. And I was still working at FanDuel at the time. And they had told me, they were totally cool. FanDuel was awesome. They were just like, yeah, you can run that game. It's fine. Just let us know if it's going to interfere. But, it was all good to do both. So this was like, I'd get home at 7 or 8 o'clock at night and like just check in on the game, retool some, ads or whatever and see how it was doing, make sure there's no big bugs or something. And it just kept compounding to where it eventually was like, wow, okay, this game's now making more than my yearly salary at FanDuel. And so that was when I decided to incorporate and eventually signed a publishing deal. And FanDuel ended up closing down all their external studios during their litigated stuff, and which was like perfect opportunity for me. So then I incorporated third time and then hired two people to kind of run with it. And yeah, it's been the case ever since. It's pretty wild.
That's amazing. Wow. I mean, yeah, that growth is sounds incredible, especially with just Facebook ads is amazing.
Old days though, it was like 10 cents per install. God, I miss those days.
That's awesome. All right. So tell me about the idea behind Photo Finish. What was the first incarnation of the game?
Yeah, the original was actually kind of CSR racing inspired. That was a game that I played a lot and I understood, and I really dug the mechanics of that game from a monetization standpoint as well as from a design standpoint. I thought there was something really special to a mobile game that could give you meaningful progress in like 30 seconds. That's where I thought was like the big differentiator that a lot of people would miss, especially EAs or the big companies. They would bring their big console experience to mobile. And I just thought, well, like the way I enjoy this is like I'm literally parked, waiting for the next order in the fast food line or the Starbucks line. I want to be able to open it up, do something, and then close it, and it matter. And so I thought, well, that's actually really great. Horse racing is this. I could just run this quick sprint. I made a quick prototype, and I made like 3 or 4 different variations on the mechanic. I was really like super hyper focused on the mechanic feeling good and sound effects and all the stuff that the juice that you have to put on things. And I had that up and running really quick, and I was just showing it to friends like, what do you think? And they would all just laugh. They're like, horse racing, what? I'm like, I don't know, there's nothing else out there. What do you think? Is this fun? And I showed like my cousin, people that don't really play games, and they're like, oh man, this gets the juices flowing. The first race, the noses are moving close, and there's all this stuff that I could do to really kind of get the competitive vibe going. And so that was really it. It was like try and take a bite-sized 20-second, session with a really loose metagame of upgrades and then monetize the upgrades with timers. And I just did, I had the whole game running in a spreadsheet, well before I built any of the real actual code or any of the engine or any of that stuff, anything in Unity. I had a game where you could, simulate race, win or lose, and then see how much money you made and then how you rolled the money back into the thing. It was just purely a like math And then when would I introduce timers? And when would you level up? And when would you do your energy? And, you know, I just did all of that, like, really in depth. And so that I thought, okay, well, this, you know, this breaks itself into 5 days of gameplay by tuning it this way. And that was it. I mean, like, the game didn't do anything extra after that. It was really like a week's worth of gameplay. And then you would kind of be done. And there was a, you know, I eventually put in a pop-up. It's like, you know, if you finish these levels, contact us on Twitter to see if you're, you know, and then eventually it was like, all of a sudden I'm getting hammered with posts like, hey, when are more levels coming? When's new? And I was like, oh my God, they're playing it. They're beating it, you know? But that was really it. And it's kind of wild to think like there was just these little, you know, upgrades that would cost 5 minutes or 15 minutes or 30 minutes to, you know, or you could pay premium currency to skip it. Obviously, real standard free-to-play trope. It's like that was millions of dollars. That little, like, wait 15 minutes, you know, ended up generating. So it's pretty crazy. But yeah, it was a very, very simple arcade game. It was really like, I think it sort of balanced all the things that I had learned and done to that point. It was like the AAA, like, sports competitive part of, you know, that I'd learned from Madden, making sure the presentation was really good. The cameras were shaking and trembling, you know, getting the sound good, you know, all that stuff that I learned from AAA. And then some of that stuff that I'd learned from Zynga, like the session times and really making sure that it was, you know, bite-sized, like, good progression, you know, and it ran on every device and, yeah, super easy to play for anyone. That was it. And yeah, it, I mean, that game, I just pulled it off the App Store this year, only because it was confusing people with the new Photo Finish Live, but it actually was still running and still making money. So I'm actually trying to get it back up. Just going to rename it. It's pretty wild.
That's awesome. Wow. Okay. So, all right. Tell me about, you know, this new version of Photo Finish that you've been, you know, cooking, and why you decided to utilize Web3. Cause I feel like for so many game developers and especially you know, gamers, Web3 is like, absolutely no, like, you know, no token, no NFT, no anything. So like, tell me like, this new, you know, incarnation of the game, and then why Web3?
Yeah, yeah. And the word NFT is toxic at this point. So I try to never even say that word at this point. Yeah, I mean, it was a kind of natural extension. So we built a sequel. So Photo Finish, the original, had again these really, really great early retention, but as I said, it only lasted about a week. You know, it was like kind of out of content, and so we made a sequel or a follow up. Which same sort of racing and all that stuff that was in there, but we thought, well, how do we take this and, you know, take the parts that people were pretty interested in, like breeding, and make it a much longer tail game, you know? And the pitch that I made to the team was sort of like, we want a game where people are creating Wikipedia pages about how the breeding algorithm works, you know, like I want like stuff that will scratch their brain forever. And so Paul, CTO, he started digging into genetics and was just like, well, what if we actually did real genomes and all of these things? And so that was our follow-up game, was Horse Racing Manager, which wasn't arcade. It was much more a breeding simulation with all these, you know, genetic things that we were starting to kind of build up and work out. And that one actually did pretty okay. I mean, it had really bad early game retention. It was very much like hardcore simulation game. So people would boot up and then they would just like, oh, this is not for me. Which was okay. But then the people that we would find, they would be huge spenders. You know, the max spender in the original game was maybe $250. And the biggest spender in the second game was like $300,000. You know, they were very, very whale heavy, super obsessed. You know, there were people that were real horse breeders that really loved it, real horse owners. And so that second game was doing pretty good. It was okay. It was kind of a bad fit for our publishing agreement, and our relationship really soured during that. And so in my head, when I started to see Web3 really click, specifically Top Shot, it was just like, oh, this is the right place for this game. The manager game is where they can really own all of these things. Like the original Horse Racing Manager, it's like, you know, they're buying from us. It's loot boxes. It's gacha. It's all these things that are very like predatory almost. And I didn't really like building that stuff either. It was just, you know, you think back to all the stuff I did in Photo Finish, from tuning the cameras and the polish. Here in Horse Racing Manager, I'm tuning how often they get screwed in a loot box, you know, and stuff. And it's just like, oh, it's really never clicked. as well. And so I thought, well, this is an interesting thing. You know, these players right now that are playing and they're spending huge sums of money, again, hundreds of thousands of dollars. What if they could make that money back? What if they owned everything? We got out of the way. We were no longer an arbiter of anything. What would that look like? So I started just kind of like typing up design briefs of just figuring out what would that be? How would that work in Web3? And that was really the start. It was like, again, the pitch to the team was, what if JP, who was one of the players of our original game, who had spent so much money, so much time, he was like unbelievable at the game. We were often asking him, what did you do? How did you do that? You know, like he had beaten a lot of our algorithms and stuff. So my pitch to the team was, what if JP can become a millionaire in this game? How does that look? How would that work? You know, and so that was a lot of the drive of like, let's allow people to buy and sell from each other. Let's allow them to race with each other and let's start working on it. And that was really it. I mean, we started in like, you know, November of 2021. We had the beta done in May or June. And we just like brought a lot of the stuff over and we're really just like, let's see if it works. And it has. it was the right thesis for sure.
That's awesome. Okay. So when you're explaining photo finish to those that have like no idea, how do you pitch it? Do you say like, hey, we're a fantasy sports, you know, horse racing game, or what is that pitch?
Yeah. A lot of it is really like, it's the exact same as becoming a real life horse owner without the animal. You know, I try to kind of start there, depending on who I'm talking to, of course. There's some people that if they've been playing Madden forever, it'd be like, oh, it's, you know, similar to a daily fantasy or this, or, you know, an ultimate team where you're collecting a stable. But, you know, if I'm telling my mom, it's like, it's no different from owning a horse. You're racing them in races, you're breeding them, you're doing all of that stuff, but you don't have to deal with caring for an animal. It's all virtual. Oh, okay, cool. So that's really where I start. I think for the most part, people can get that. And there's, you know, it's not like everyone in the world, but there's a lot of people that have been like, man, it would be cool to win the Kentucky Derby, but how do I even do it? I mean, I've been interested in horse racing, and it wasn't until last year where I finally was able to figure out how to get ownership of a horse. Like, it feels impossible. It feels, you know, very daunting to like inject yourself into this industry in any way. Whereas I think with fantasy football and things, you can kind of like, oh yeah, I've got my team and I got this and I go buy the jerseys and, you know, like you can very much get deeper into the sport of football. Horse racing is a lot harder to do that. You just go gamble on the sport and that's it. Whereas I thought with this, it's like, well, it is actually pretty interesting to like live that life, being in the winner's circle. You don't have to like do any of the hard stuff figuring out how to feed a horse or what do they eat? You know, I don't know.
All right. So within the game, there's a whole bunch of different kind of actions you can take and things you can do. There's racing, breeding, there's a marketplace for trading. Can you kind of describe, you know, what are the different, things that users can actually do and what kind of like games and fun they can have during, you know, the actual experience?
Yeah. There's almost like three distinct player style, cohorts or what have you that you can go try and be. So the first is racing. I mean, I think that's obviously really, really fun, is just get a horse and go find out where he's good. A lot of people, that might be their entry point. Just get a cheap horse and start seeing if you can win some money. That's always pretty straightforward and fun. And then there's sort of like the deeper metagame is breeding. And that can take years. You know, these horses, they age every single month, they age a year. And so as they're getting older, you're wanting to make more bloodlines. You're wanting to try and, you know, find other ones that craft well with yours. And that's a much longer and deeper metagame, but also could be wildly entertaining if you're into that level of strategy. I mean, it's an impossible puzzle to crack. There's genetics involved. There's all kinds of like deep bloodlines across the entire ecosystem. So you're trying to find the perfect pairing. And it's really early too. So you're trying to like set yourself up for years to come. And then the other is sort of like participating in the real money side of it without owning the horse. So there's two angles there. Number one is wagering, and that's limited to very few territories and states right now. But that's one way to do it. You just come in just like real life and say, oh yeah, I think the 2 and the 4 are going to win this race and wager on it as a spectator. And then the other is claiming, which is new to a lot of people, but one of the most fun ways to play a game like this. So a claiming race, people don't really realize in horse racing, nearly 70% of the horse races in the U.S. are claiming races. And what does that mean is just really when I enter my horse into the race, he's for sale. And so it basically means that you're never going to put your top tier horses in these races because they'll get bought out from under you. So it's this sort of like down in the lower tiers, it's a way for people to go, oh, okay, well, he's on sale. He's a little cheaper than he should be here. I think he might win and I might be able to snag him for a deal and I'll put him in the next tier up claimer. You know, maybe I bought him for 10K. I think I can sell him for 20 and maybe he'll even get a win. And so you get a lot of this, like almost in real life, it's almost like crypto flippers where they're, you know, picking up horses here and there and like, oh, if I can get him over into the one in Texas, it's actually cheaper and I'm going to have a higher purse. And so there's just like a lot of strategy and fun of just this like marketplace movement game of flipping horse sales in the claiming game. So those are sort of the three strategies and angles. And it's interesting to see some people do all of them. Others only just like hyper-focus into one. And yeah, there's a lot of different ways to play.
Can you describe the economy? Because, you know, you're talking about earning and kind of this money aspect. Is that US dollars or is there like a crypto token or how are people like earning?
Yeah, so everything we do in the game is based off of a virtual currency in the game that you can basically consider US dollars. It's the same. It's always stable. It's not tradable. It's not moving around or crazy. You don't even need crypto to get it. You can just get it in the game. It's the same as having Fortnite V-Bucks or Microsoft points. That's all it is. So if someone wants to get involved into buying a real horse or a real virtual horse or, you know, racing or any of that, you just use basically a stable currency. We call it Derby and can interact that way.
That's awesome. And the actual winnings, like, so you can win Derby, which is, you know, quasi money. And then you can you like win horses or win, like, are there any other assets like, you know, I don't know, stables or something that you can win?
Yeah. So the other side of it is once you get a little bit deeper is there is crypto integration with our token called Crown. And so the Crown token is tradable out on the market. It is, people are out there doing all kinds of speculative stuff with it. I don't pay attention to it. But what we do, especially in this first year or so of the game, is we're trying to incentivize people to play. You know, we're trying to get more and more players in. So that's one way you can also interact with this economy is every time you're racing, you are earning Crown as a gift, basically. It's sort of we call them stimmies as our sort of affectionate, but Crown stimmies are getting rewarded based on how much you're playing. And that's sort of the way to help sort of solve that cold start problem of like, this is a multiplayer game. It's only fun if there's lots of players playing a multiplayer game. Obviously you can't go play a shooter or anything when there's no one online. And same with horse racing. It's got to have actually some people there. So this is part of our strategy of like, we dedicated a huge chunk of our treasury to, you know, basically incentivize and grow the game for these beginning, you know, months and years. And so that's the other way to build. And then in the coming, you know, probably quarter or two, there are ways you can race for free right now. You can enter the game and just get a free horse and you race in these trainer series races. But in the coming months, like those will also have, you know, leaderboards and you're similar to a free to play game. If you're working your way up that leaderboard, then you can earn real money horses, you know, real value horses, real crypto, real crown, real derby. So there are ways that we are working to sort of like get people to graduate in. But right now it's been so crazy just that there's enough people coming in that are ready to play for real money. We don't have it needed to graduate the free to the paid yet. But, you know, you think about us going and bringing out a mobile app, a mobile game in the future, you obviously need to expand the funnel as wide as we can. So that stuff's coming.
Is there any, have you observed any cool or interesting like user behavior? Like are any users like, I don't know, becoming obsessive with the breeding or like, are they forming teams and they're racing? Like, I don't know, anything that's kind of notable?
God, there's so many, man. It has been that part. I mean, obviously stressful as this has been building in the middle of this like Web3 crazy world where rugs are happening all over the place. People are losing their money. All kinds of nuts stuff is happening. To kind of look at the personal stories has been amazing. So I'll do a couple, I guess, anecdotes. Number one, I guess, is the D Stables. So D Gods is one of the top NFT projects. Over a year ago, they formed a DAO, a sub DAO, that would buy horses together. They had over 200 members. And the whole point there being, can we afford more horses than we could just if we're one person? And so they've rallied around that so much. They now have over hundreds of horses. It's a six-figure value of a stable. They're racing all the time. They just won the virtual Kentucky Derby. And this is like a group of people that has never, none of them cared about horse racing. They never have gone to a horse race. You know, this is like really delighted and engaged their community with something to do. And they now are trying to figure out, okay, who's the owner? How are we going to set up a board of directors around, you know, this sort of entity that's become super valuable because they were just grinding it out, racing, breeding, you know, all, doing all the stuff. So that's been super great to see, that like other communities within crypto or even not even outside of crypto that can like kind of rally together and buy a single horse. And now it's like every Friday night, they've got something to do. They can get on Discord. They can chat about it. They're, you know, it's just like having your favorite sports team, but you've got an ownership stake in it. So that's been really great to see. The others I think are the stories of the people that had the conviction, you know, and have been here. I mean, there's quite a few of our stables that have been here since day one in Discord every single day, have memorized like wallets and create, you know, they've gotten so in, they're like in the matrix, seeing the numbers fly by. And some of those folks, you know, there's one that posted that, you know, he and his wife now can do IVF treatments that they were struggling to do before because he sold a bunch of his horses. Another guy that just clipped, you know, $70,000 in 3 days in virtual stud fees, selling the seed of his stud. And I'm like, wow, we've really got something special, you know, that like, I don't even really care about the numbers because who knows what's going to happen. Like more people, numbers lower, go higher. It's like, these are life-changing things, that people like, got into, you know, playing a game in a very strategic, skillful way, and it's like changed their life. So that's the part that's really exciting to me. I mean, there were people dressing as our NFTs for Halloween and stuff yesterday. It was just like, wow, we really entered a weird corner of the internet here.
That's awesome. So I think you're an official partner of Churchill Downs and the Kentucky Derby. Like, how did that happen?
Yeah, that was a really exciting moment because we negotiated and talked with Churchill for over 2 years. They are super protective of their brand, rightfully so. If you look at like compared to NASCAR, which has like 400 sponsors, right? Kentucky Derby has like six. You know, it's always the same names. It's always Woodford Reserve and Coca-Cola and BMW. You know, it's really not anything crazy. And so to see Woodford, Coca-Cola, BMW, third time is a pretty strange, surreal experience. But I think really for them, you know, the problem that we presented to them that we think that we could help solve is that the Kentucky Derby is a massive event. It's in Louisville and it's once a year. So how can it be worldwide all year round? What can happen to keep the Kentucky Derby on people's minds, not just in Louisville and also not just in May? Or the lead up to May. And so that was really the design of our game with this sort of yearly rollover every month. It felt like this might actually be a perfect fit, you know, and I was really hesitant. I wasn't trying to get, you know, again, I worked on Madden for many years and working with licensors can be extremely difficult. There was a lot of struggle dealing with the NFL and the players and the owners. And I thought, well, I'm not like jumping into this willy-nilly. I don't really need a licensor telling me what I can and can't do. But after meeting with them, they're just amazing. Like, and so they were really like, let's try something to grow this sport. And, you know, we want to help you guys build, you know, something interesting and cutting edge. You know, let's use our might and marketing power. And then you guys hopefully can bring more young people into this game or into this sport. And also do it year round, you know. And so we've got some exciting stuff coming up there. I mean, we just signed this agreement. It's a multi-year agreement, so it's not like we're almost done. We're looking at the 150th anniversary of the Kentucky Derby is this May, which is just this massive event. And we're planning all kinds of stuff leading up to it. I mean, I think here pretty soon, December 6th, it's 150 days until 150th Derby. So I believe that's when things will really start taking off. But yeah, it's been super exciting. I mean, I actually have a meeting with them on Friday to go through some of the really cool stuff that we got going on. And it's very early. Like, I hate always saying that. It's early. We're so early. But at the same time, it's like, this is a big organization and company. And we're just getting started with some of the cool ideas and integrations we can do.
All right, so let's get a, you know, let's think about like the future, hypothetical. Let's say you had like unlimited money, unlimited resources. Where would you want to take Photo Finish? Like what would be like wave a magic wand and you could just make it happen? Like what would that look like?
Yeah, I mean, I do think about that sometimes. Like what are we going to do with this thing? I mean, I look at it as it's a companion to the real life sport that is kind of unparalleled. Like there's a lore and a history and a backstory for every horse in the game, just like there is in real life. And so I think about the future of us being integrated with the real life racing industry. So if you go to any off-track betting site, you'd say, okay, they're racing at Penn National, they're racing at Churchill, they're racing on Photo Finish Live. And those are all in the same thing because there's no reason they shouldn't be. Virtual racing can fill in holes. It costs nothing to operate compared to like putting on a race in real life. And it doesn't have to replace the real industry. The real thoroughbreds are still super exciting, but it's like there's a lot of time when it's too cold to race, when it's not the right time of year. They're like, we can really fill in these holes and allow a new generation of owners to enter the sport. That otherwise, again, if you live in a big city, are you ever going to really care about horse care and getting them into a stable? I mean, obviously, if you live out in Louisville, it's amazing to be around the industry. But if you're not there, or if you're in a country entirely that doesn't even support it, this is sort of a really great way to approach the sport and to be involved in it. So I think that's a critical next juncture, is just that we are in the same conversation. When you go to a sports book, when you go to a casino, when you go to an off-track betting, when you go to the real track, Photo Finish races are running on your mobile app, on your FanDuel, on your DraftKings. That's where I think we should be.
That's awesome. Wow. All right. So moving away from Photo Finish, I want to talk just about like your game development experience, because it's obviously, you know, insane. So, you know, you've been doing this, you've been building games in this business for 23 years. What are the key lessons of creating a great game? Because I feel like, you know, I feel like it's a, and tell me if I'm wrong, but hit-driven business where everyone's always trying to strive to create this, you know, the next big thing. And it's so difficult to do so. It's like, you know, bottling lightning, right? So it's like, how do you do that? What are these key learnings that you have? And you're like, this is how you create a great game. It's ABC. Or is it not like that at all?
Well, it's definitely not reproducible. You know, it is very much a hit-driven business. And obviously, I've made plenty of games that did nothing and went nowhere as well. So I do try to lean on like a little bit of a toolbox, and it's the same stuff when I talk to college students or when I give speeches or talks or whatever. There is, you know, sort of a few pronged approach that you can take, but at the same time, it doesn't guarantee success at all. But you can see some of the things that I went through with Photo Finish as sort of the basis. So, I mean, the first I try to do is always, and I say it all the time, focus on the core. And if you think of your game as a bullseye, you know, what a target. What is on the outside ring? What is on the middle ring? And what is in the inside? And don't build anything on the outside until the inside is basically perfect. And so if you think back to the original Photo Finish, that was the economy. That was the spreadsheet. That was what had to work before you built any of the other parts. And Photo Finish Live was similar. It was like, before we build any cameras and sound, and camera shake and bell ringing when the door opens, you know, those are all great polish that matter. And that is later in my, you know, bullseye. You have to have the core dead on working well. It can't tip over at scale. You have to simulate this stuff. I mean, almost every game I've ever made that was a success, we had everything working from an economy standpoint down well before we built anything else. And so that's free to play, of course. You know, if you're making Madden or console games, totally different. If you're making the outside ring, let's say you're not doing a free to play and you don't care about economy, then to me, I mentioned it earlier, the juice. And so many people miss that. But like, go play Candy Crush or go play Spider-Man or anything like that, and notice that the amount of care and detail to everything. So Candy Crush, like, the little bounces and bloops as you swipe things, they expand. And I mean, this Apple's the same way. the amount of bounce and inertia that they give to, you know, as you scroll. There's a funny, if you go watch the original Steve Jobs iPhone announcement video, at some point has his address book contact list, and he's scrolling and pulling it down, and it bounces back up. It's got that sort of rubber band inertia. And you could tell that's where I was like, he cares about. He's like, look, how isn't this nice? Doing, 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 you know, and so that's the juice. A lot of people skip that. You know, when I see student projects at the local college and I go and try and talk with those kids, I mean, they don't see that. And it's like, it feels cheap and busted if your stuff is not wiggling and bouncing and animating and squishing and squashing and making sounds and vibrating. And that is unfortunately like a lot of time. It takes a lot of work to get that feeling right and tuned. But I mean, the new Spider-Man game, which I've been playing a ton for a week, is just masterclass in that level of extra polish and feel on swinging, on punches. Everything has so much juice added to just the core action. So those are typically the two I say is like, you know, your bullseye of making sure that you really dig in on don't exit the core until you're really dialed in. And so when I even give that example of Spider-Man now, it's like, if you're making a Spider-Man game, you shouldn't do anything until swinging feels amazing, right? It's like swinging through the city should feel, all of the stuff should feel perfect. And there's videos of them, that's what they had, just white boxes all around. And you're swinging and jumping and traversing through the city. Whereas like, typically what a game dev team might do is like, let's go build a mission. Let's go build a boss battle. Let's start texturing all the buildings. Let's see, you know, what happened? What does the water look like? You know, and you end up start getting into, and it's so hard because once you spread your team into the things that they're good at, then it's hard to get back into that core. And then of course you end up down the line with a core that's not very fun and balanced and then no one will play it. So, I don't know, easier said than done, especially nowadays when games cost like, you know, $500 million to make. But if you're making an indie game, you have an indie idea, a little small thing, maybe it's a puzzle, maybe it's a little platformer, you know, you should really like do it in white box form and make sure all the juice is dialed in before you go on to building new levels, making new art, making any of that stuff.
That's awesome. All right. So I feel like we're kind of entering, or maybe we're in it right now, but we're entering the golden era of like the future of entertainment, or just the entertainment industry, you might say, because we have really cool technology that I feel like is kind of converging and enabling a lot more new either user behavior or even build outs from the actual development, from the development standpoint, or like new experiences as well. We have, you know, blockchain for kind of financialization, monetization. We have AR and VR for kind of the actual experience, AI, both for, you know, the user standpoint, from like an intelligence standpoint for NPCs and whatnot, or from the game development standpoint, making it a lot easier. What are your thoughts on kind of this, these new technologies that are popping up specifically? Like I'll talk about right now, like AI, because it's been all the rage the past year. Has AI impacted your business at all, or even like your thought process of how to build a great game?
Oh, massively. I don't talk about it enough because I feel like everyone talks about it, but I can talk about AI forever. I mean, so the moment GPT came out, I mean, I was like, our Slack channel internally, we were like, I think we just jumped timelines. Like it felt like this unreal. And then all of a sudden GPT-4 came out and I'm like, oh my God. And so personally, as much as I hate to say this, because I am a game developer. I mean, we had a contract development team building almost all of our front end work, team of four people, and they're no longer needed because of ChatGPT. We do all that stuff with GPT now. Every one of us on the team has a premium subscription and just build 90% of our front end features are built by AI now. It's just been unbelievable. And when I add someone to the team, when we hired a new kid from the university, I was like, yeah, we had a GPT training course. You know, that's what it is now. It's crazy to me what's going to happen. Cause like I have so many ideas that I feel like I could just rip on, but I'm in the middle of building a product. If I was in college or if I was like in between jobs right now, or if I didn't have like this massively like stressful project, God, I would be building so many crazy things. And so that's what everyone else is doing right now. They're raising rounds or they're doing this and doing that. And so it is mind-blowing what you can build with it as a developer, how it can bridge the gaps of knowledge that you didn't have, as well as some of the really trippy stuff of getting it to build recursively and talk to itself and have multiple agents deal with each other. And I mean, I saw something not long ago that there won't be engineers 5 years from now, and I don't disagree. It will be prompt engineering. You'll be helping it.
5 years from now, you think that we might not have engineers?
I don't see why I would write any code 5 years from now. Why would I? It's so good now. I barely, all I do now is copy and paste in what they tell me to do. Wow. Why do I even do that? You know, yeah. Now that's so early and it's very at the beginning, but it's like, I've got the idea. I've got the UX I want to build. I've got the feature I want to build. Why would I need to write any of this glue? Of course I read it, make sure they're not introducing some security vulnerability or whatever. But over time, again, this is so early, like that will all get fixed. And so I think it's going to be a massive game changer. I mean, I do think that, what does that do? It's going to disrupt a lot of stuff. I mean, it's probably net positive, but you know, what does that do to the engineering industry and all of us? I don't know. I mean, maybe it lets us all be way more creative, or maybe it just like torpedoes all developer salaries. I really don't know. And that part I try to not think about, because I still think, yeah, that you still got to come up with the idea and you got to explain to the machine what you want it to do. But at some level, I mean, I've already seen examples of people saying like, hey, can you just add chat to my site? And then it'll do it. It'll in a recursive loop and it'll send it to another agent for the review, and that one will catch stuff. And, you know, like when they can kind of work together, it's mind blowing what you can build. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's so exciting. It's somewhat terrifying, but it's so exciting. And like just what it's done for us, how it's freed us up to, you know, again, just like be able to be a lean team and just experiment with things and try things. I mean, there's just so much stuff that like it's Stack Overflow, but on steroids times a million. I don't know. but anyway, I use it all the time, and our team uses it all the time, and it has been a massive game changer for us. I mean, the people that have seen, you know, obviously the really challenging year that Third Time had, and pretty much every game dev team in crypto had. I mean, there's no way we wouldn't have survived without ChatGPT. I mean, there's no, like all of the building, all of the features that we built, everything that we were able to roll out was AI assisted, and we would have had to hire large teams to help us build that prior. And we didn't. And so, you know, one level I'm like thankful, but on the other, I'm like, well, crap, that means I'm at risk in the future because this AI can figure out and do what I can do. In terms of the game design stuff, it's weird right now to see some companies like raising funds on like, hey, we've made NPCs smarter. You know, I'm like, that stuff to me is sort of stupid. Like, okay, you're just talking to ChatGPT. There's so many businesses that are just raising on, hey, we've wrote cool things on top of ChatGPT, which is weird. You know, I don't know, whatever. Maybe it'll work out, maybe it won't. But I think that the creativity someone's gonna crack of, you know, having these storylines get built dynamically throughout your game because it can just sort of run with it. Once GPT gets much better at memory, which is again so bad at right now, and longer things, you know, it's just like the world is going to expand in such a wild way in terms of gaming or interactive or virtual experiences. You know, virtual girlfriends, that stuff's definitely going to be happening on her, all these things, virtual boyfriends. It's going to be totally wild. And you know, like another one that we use on Photo Finish is we every time a race finishes, we send this unreadable JSON blob of data to GPT through the API, and it writes a news article about the race.
So cool.
And then we tell it to inject SEO words. I hate to, like, this is one of our secrets that we're doing, but you know, key phrases and keywords that we want to start ranking for. We just started doing this about a month ago, and we're using GPT 3.5 because 4 is too expensive on the API. We can't quite get it to it's not just too expensive. It won't do it as much as we need. But it's like things like that that are going to be kind of, you will not be able to tell that a human didn't write that or did. And for us, you know, like how much would it cost or take to write an article about a race that you'd have to have someone actually watch and figure out? And not only that, the AI can see like, oh, those two raced before 6 months ago, and I can talk about that. You know, again, once history gets deeper and better, there's like the world's become so much more rich because they can find and notice things that we just, even if we were paying multiple full-time employees to like, hey, I want you to be the sports beat of the photo finish live ecosystem, they wouldn't catch. And this thing is like just turning it out like every second, every 5 minutes, it writes an article that's actually pretty good. So yeah, it's just, it's fascinating. And I can't wait to use it more. I kind of wish I had less stuff to do on photo finish because I would love to be building just purely AI driven weird ideas. Maybe in a year or two.
That's so cool. It sounds like this is great for the little, you know, the little guy, like in terms of being able to compete with like an EA or, you know, some large game company, you can now, you know, punch way above your weight. And so in that sense, it seems like a huge force multiplier and like kind of evening the playing field a bit towards, you know, indie game devs that want to create cool things, but like, are like, man, I don't have the resources, but now it's like, maybe I can take a swing here.
Absolutely. You can learn as well. Like you can, you know, if programming was just not going to be something that clicked, like now you can kind of like have a personalized teacher walking you through these things. Hey, I don't understand. What does that function mean? Why did you do it that way? You know, so you can educate yourself, not just like have it build it for you. But I think, again, like when I think about the democratization of mobile app development that happened with Unity and the App Store, you know, you think about making a game on the App Store in 2010 versus making it today. There's just tens of thousands of games and apps getting submitted every day. No one can find anything. It's going to get worse. It's going to get infinitely worse that anyone can make a game. They can like, wouldn't it be cool if you had a game that could order pizza for you while you're playing, you know, and it's like, it's done. And now they submit it to the App Store. It's just like every dumb idea can make it all the way through. All the good ones can too, but like all the cruft, it's going to be really hard eventually too, to tell, was this all AI generated? Was it, did a human have anything to do with this? And so I think that's one of the problem areas of gaming. Mobile has obviously just sort of mobile gaming. It's obviously still huge, but it's so hard to get noticed. So being an indie mobile game dev is kind of impossible. And then now that'll be the case with Steam. It already was kind of impossible. Console, kind of impossible. So it's just so crowded, and will become so easy to make a game. There'll be SDKs and game builder kits where you just type in what the world is that you want it to look like, what weapons you want, and it will do all of it. And it's sort of like, well, then that means there's 1,000 of those. And so why would I play yours or not? You know, so that will be the next big sort of problem, I think, is just this huge glut of new games and experiences and VR and AR and all these things that will, yeah, they're democratized now. Anyone can make them. So what does that mean? Probably means a lot of crap that comes out, you know.
Totally. All right. So yeah, talking about VR and AR, I feel like, you know, so many people have been saying VR is the future and AR is the future for so long. We still haven't gotten there yet. But, you know, Apple's now making their headset and that's set to release, what, I think, sometime next year. Meta's doing their smart glasses, which doesn't have AR in them today, but hopefully in the future, you know, that they'll integrate AR. So like, what does that mean from like a game dev standpoint? You know, if there's widespread, or first, like, do you think there'll be widespread AR and VR? And then also, if there is, what does that mean?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, I definitely was really bullish on VR when it first came out. But then, you know, over time, you're like, yeah, it's just such a unique, it's not all that different from sitting down at your console. And it's just like, it's just another platform. I mean, I don't really like it that much. My kids love it. They seem to be okay with it. I kind of just like, I can't sit and enjoy it that much. It's just uncomfortable and you feel weird. And of course, there's just like the nausea that happens on a lot of these games. And I would much rather sit on my couch comfortably than like stand around and do these things. But that's, you know, old guy talking. So VR to me still feels like that's always going to be the problem, is like, it's just too clunky and, you know, not going to be fully mainstream. But you can still make millions of dollars making a good game on VR. You can still, like, especially if you're indie, maybe it's a sort of niche that you could find. You may look at games that I've played on there, like Superhot and a few others that are like, yeah, this is perfect. This is awesome. This is almost the killer app for like everyone wanting to go like, I need to get VR. I've heard that about the PSVR2, that like Gran Turismo is the killer app. That's the one to get. I haven't got it. I was hoping to like buy it for myself for Christmas or something. You know, having something like that, that is the reason to buy it, you know, will kick off. AR, of course, has a lot more potential because it doesn't require all the, you know, shrouding yourself out from the real world. But at the same time, it's similar. It feels like it's like, what's going to be the killer app? Almost everyone is kind of focused on like, hey, you can just make a bigger TV than you normally could. Or, I mean, I loved the Apple Vision Pro video. Of course, like the price point's insane, but I loved that notion of getting on a plane and shutting out the outside world and having, you know, all of that stuff sort of, which is basically VR, but it was AR version of it. But in terms of games, I mean, I think it's like, it's really about, it's a new platform that is probably a great niche for you to tackle if you are an indie. Because the EAs and the Zynga, you know, the Activisions, they're probably not going to jump in on, you know, hardware that hasn't quite taken off. And that's a great area for the indies to try and build something that does take off. You know, I remember when I first got, one of the first VR headsets, and I built like a ski jump simulator, and I never released it or anything, but I thought like, you know, I could have made a couple hundred grand if I had finished that, because it's just sort of like, there's nothing like that. And it's, you sell it for $5 and it's just sort of like one of those things that you show your friends and you're like, this is crazy. And then you fall and it, you know, you go tumbling down this mountain, and there's always like, because that is so unique and sort of niche by itself, that I think that's sort of maybe when I would, you know, recommend the smaller developers to try and dig in on. You can find a community, you could find a group of, you know, smaller, you're not going to compete with the Spider-Man's on PS5. But you're able to like do some quirky, funny thing. I mean, like my kids play that job simulator all the time. Like they just pretending to serve at work at a 7-Eleven. I'm like, all right, you know, cool. That's a great idea. You know, it's just like, that's not going to work anywhere else.
Do you have any specific views around AR? Because I feel like VR, I agree, it's more akin to like playing video games. It's like you go and do it and it's very intentional. AR for me seems like, I mean, this is my thought process, but I feel like it's going to be ubiquitous. It's going to be like replace the smartphone and everyone's going to have AR glasses. And that's just like how we're going to interact with like the internet. How do you view AR?
I can definitely see it. I mean, I think, you know, glasses or even contacts, if it becomes that level of technology, you know, like everything being heads up display, I could definitely see. I mean, you look around right now, it is kind of insane to look at the world with everyone staring down into this little mirror, the black mirror, when they are missing out on the entire world around them. And there's so many times where I've been like, I'm going to not pull my phone out as I walk from like here to work or something. And you're just like, huh, I didn't know that building was there. I didn't, you know, oh, they tore that thing down. And, you know, just like, we're all missing out on the entire outside world because they're just buried in this thing. So I could definitely see the happiness factor. If something were to work well, that everyone would be telling all their friends like, dude, you got it. This is way better than staring down at your phone. You got to use it. At the same time, I mean, there's a lot of functionality in this mirror, and almost every user interface within AR is clunky and strange. And a lot of people say, okay, Apple kind of solved it. There's a lot of like, they've sort of figured out where your eyes are looking and all of these things within Vision Pro, but that's also this spaceship headset. Can that work in glasses ever? Of course, you imagine, yes, everything can be possible given time and money, but is it 30 years or is it 5? Or the two, you know, I don't know. But yeah, I mean, obviously I could see myself for sure driving to work and just seeing stuff scrolling by and like, you know, talking to it or just looking at it briefly. That would be way better than people like glancing back and forth at their phone. So I don't know. I could definitely see it. I just, it doesn't feel like a great gaming platform. I've seen, obviously, I had one of our employees worked at Magic Leap for a long time, and he brought us the demos and showed us all these things. And it was pretty magical, you know, like all of a sudden, like a hole opened up in my wall and an alien came out and I shot it and stuff. But most of the time it doesn't work. And like your lighting's wrong or there's a curtain and that doesn't work. And it's just a really hard technical problem having to deal with everyone's environment. Whereas I think, you know, having more like heads up display stuff is a lot easier to project on the glass or whatever.
That makes sense. All right, Ian, this has been amazing, but it is time for the closing questions. All righty. What are you bearish on?
What am I bearish on? Oh my gosh. Slow blockchains.
Slow blockchains.
Yeah, slow blockchains. I guess I'm just bearish on the fact that a slow database will ever work. That's one. It's you can think of it just like looking back at the original start of tech. I mean, it's always going to be a race to zero and a race to speed and cost. And so eventually anything that's not cheap and fast will have to adapt or die, right? That's what I think.
Totally. All right. What are you bullish on? You cannot say photo finish.
Virtual horse racing, I'm super bullish on. I'm hyper bullish on AI and how it's going to change our world for the better. I mean, not just games or anything, but like cancer studies and, you know, just things like I lost my dad in 2018 to cancer. And you just think through like, man, the medical advancements that are coming in probably in the decade to catch just your blood test is different. And we've noticed that has been linked to this. And, you know, there's things like that, that, you know, I've always been hypochondriac. I'm just very worried about all these things too. And all that shit is raw with me. And so I just think the advancements of AI to like really help our quality of life in general, I'm super bullish on.
That's awesome. All right. I think you kind of answered this question, but are you an AGI doomer or optimist?
Optimist. But I do think there's a lot of things that'll go wrong on the way there for sure. I do think it eventually will smooth itself out, but I do think there's going to be a lot of thrash and disruption for sure in culture and everything. You know?
There's a lot of folks out there that say that artificial general intelligence could actually like lead to the end of the world, perhaps. Is that you know, in your mind possible?
Or yeah.
Is that like, okay.
Yeah. I mean, I not to get like too smoking a J in my dorm room thing, but I think the future of like humanity in this Fermi paradox stuff, where like, why is there no one else around already? You know, if we've made this much progress in 1,000 years, like where's everyone else that started 1 billion years ago? And I do think that humanity will always probably end itself accidentally or purposely, but I think AI could be one of those things. I think, particle physics could be one of those things. You know, it's just, it's like anything where we could be like, hey, we figured out how to do interstellar travel, and then we accidentally open up a black hole and just destroy ourselves. Yeah, I don't know. Who knows? I make that joke a lot that like, it's going to be the last moment we'll be like, whoa, check this out. It worked, you know, and then they press the button. It's like, ooh. It just feels like that's kind of inevitable, that there's some mind-bending physics trick that we figure out that we do wrong or AI. You know, they accidentally exterminate us all because we told them to be more efficient. It also could easily work.
Paperclip theory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, but overall optimistic. So that's a positive note. What is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
I wish my dad had given it to me. He actually gave it to my cousin, and my cousin filled me in on it later. But it was really if you feel like you've upset someone or you've done something wrong, and you know your typical, at least mine, is obsess about it. Oh, I did this wrong. He always said that person forgot. They've gone on with their own crap in their life. They're moving on. Yes, they could be upset with you in the moment, or even disappointed or whatever it is. But like then they went and they dealt with like, oh, I got to get groceries and I've got to do this. So it's over. Move on. Don't obsess. That's been one of the things that
love that. That's awesome.
That's pretty good.
All right. Last question. What motivates you?
Yeah, I am hyper motivated. My wife asked me this, why are you doing all this? I am obsessed, of course, with some level of my obsession of work is to be out of my own head. There's a thing there where I'm not comfortable if I'm idle. But the other side is I am obsessed with the delighting of someone else, entertaining someone else, starting with a blank page and building it. No matter what, that is intoxicating for me of like, start with a blank sheet of code, paper, whatever it is, do something in my own head, and then out comes something that I can see someone smile or laugh or enjoy. That is definitely like my thing, that dopamine of seeing it work, the dopamine of seeing them like it. They tell you that it's good. You know, parents were divorced, so there's some sort of like people pleasing gene I've got. I don't know what it is, but that has always been my obsession, and I'll never give that up. I love building to entertain.
That's amazing. Ian, this has been incredible. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
If people want to talk to you, maybe learn more about Photo Finish, where should they go?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the socials, the Twitter X or whatever. You know, I think mine's Ian Cummings NFT, which I need to pull that NFT off of there. And then the Photo Finish is Photo Finish Game. But yeah, both of those are where to start. Dig in deeper from there. But yeah, obviously anybody reach out. I love talking to game devs that are building, and I always try to offer any advice or tips if they have it. I've had people send me game demos or even code or pitches, always trying to help pay it forward, because a lot of people did help me get to where I am.
Amazing. Awesome. Thank you, Ian.
Yeah, man. Thank you.
See ya.